I'm Jill Dittmeyer, and this is Curious Mix. Listen in as we meet the people and explore the places and programs celebrating the arts and culture in our communities. Keep your ears open for these sounds and the stories behind them.
And go!
At one time, if you told someone you were studying art history in college, they would roll their eyes, saying it was the major for those who had no idea what to major in. Well, not so for artist Audrey Barcio. The 39-year-old grew up in Lafayette, and she was appreciating art long before she graduated from the Heron School of Art and Design in Indianapolis and then got her MFA at the University of Las Vegas. She has a solo show at the Tube Factory Art Space near Garfield Park on the south side of Indianapolis. I met Audrey there to see her work and learn more about her upbringing, including the time she spent with her grandmother, who was a painter.
And she eventually went blind. And when I was a child, I would mix all of her paint and, you know, grab the brush for her or lay down part of the underneath layer of a painting or guide her hand to an area of a painting. So I feel that I was like introduced to art at a very, very young age, painting and learning my colors and the difference between a cool red and a hot red before I even knew the alphabet or how to count. And so when I was a child, I thought that everything was magical. I looked at it completely through the eyes of an artist, which in a way gave me a great imagination, but on the other sense, confused me. I thought that the shape of a number represented something. So when I would see the number 2 has a dominant curve in it, and I would think 2 plus 2 must be 3, because a 3 has 2 curves stacked on top of each other. So I felt like that's how I began to think when I was a child, you know, a curve or a straight edge or a line all means something.
She also found meaning in her grandmother's encyclopedias. That's where she caught her first glimpse of the work of Russian artist Kazimir Malevich. He turned the art world upside down in the early 1900s when he started using geometric shapes like circles and squares in his art, creating what is now known as the suprematist movement.
And I was just fascinated because all of his shapes are usually blocks and rectangles, squares, circles, those shapes. And they're very similar to the wooden blocks that I had growing up. And to me, I just really was inspired by it. And then as an adult, I've seen his works in person at major museums around the world or in collectors' homes, which is really great.
Angles and lines are important parts of Audrey's installation pieces. One of them includes a metronome and 2 triangular mirrors on opposite sides of the wall.
And when the viewer stands in the middle of it, you get the sense of infinity or heritage, where you're looking back at yourself and you're also looking at the future at the same time. And in the room, I've placed a metronome that's set to the average resting heart rate of a human, and it's installed on the wall at my heart level as an artist. And I like to think that the viewer can come into the room and have this contemplative moment where they're looking forward as well as back into their own life and history, but then struck by the idea of the present or the now with their heartbeat.
But it's that art history she learned from her grandmother and a revolutionary Russian artist that are most reflected in the large canvases on the walls.
I print onto the canvas, and the very basis of the painting is a gray and white checker, which is pulling from the gray and white checkered background from Photoshop. On the edges of the painting, you'll see that gray and white checker come through. So I want to reference the idea of digital technology and the influence of the virtual industrial age into our everyday lives. The images that are on the painting that are painted are geometric in shape. So there's a lot of angles, triangles into the work. So from there, I think about the ideas of work and labor. So then the paintings are hand-painted, working with different finishes between gloss and matte. And in some areas, you'll see a bit of a mica or a glitter coming through with the paintings. And almost all of them will have a line that when you first see, it's not clear. But then if you take the time, you'll see just a little pinstripe or detail. And for me, I think about with these works that if you photograph it in one way and share it, it'll flatten out and look different digitally. But if you see it in person, that's where the discovery lies. That's where you see, oh, you know, this area is black, but one of the areas is matte black and the other is a high gloss matte. And the pinstripe is very subtle. And that came to me very intuitively. I was at a residency in Vermont. It was during the solar eclipse that everybody was so thrilled for this year. And I looked at my watch and noticed that everyone left the studio building and are standing outside with their little pinhole and or their colander, and they were, you know, looking at how, you know, the light passes. And something about that moment of universal connection, I was at the same time getting, you know, text photos from my friends and family that I, you know, traveled to different areas to experience the solar eclipse. And I was also feeling very isolated and alone at that time, but at the same time connected by everybody, that I came back in my studio and I just laid down this little sliver of a line. It's very subtle. It's a fluorescent yellow, and it just made me think about how there's something that can happen in nature that can connect the entire world or segments of the United States on that day. That was really universal to me. So from that point on, I started to add a bit of a pinstripe to a lot of the paintings.
How important is it for the viewer, the person that comes to see your art, to already know a little bit about that before they look at it and go, what is that?
For me, I think that art should be universal. I work with different sheens, so there'll be a matte color or a high gloss or a little splash of fluorescent in the paintings. And I think that there's something there that's universal that goes back to, you know, the very basic shapes and colors, something that we all learned at the, you know, beginning of our education. So I'm completely open to that interpretation. I never want the work to feel unapproachable to a child or to a non-artist.
Audrey and her husband live in Chicago, where she continues to make time to create her art while working full-time for an independent gallery that represents living modern artists from around the world.
Well, the Oscars have come and gone, which means both good news and bad news for moviegoers. For you casual fans, you'll probably be able to see more of those big winners and nominees available on Netflix and Redbox, and maybe even at your local library. Great place to rent a movie. Now, if you're a diehard film fan, you probably want to catch up on your reading or do something else as you wait for those big summer blockbusters to come out. So we're going to talk a little bit about these things and more of the post-Oscar glow.
because it's time for our chat with Matt. And we welcome Matthew Soucy here once again. He's the host of Film Sociology, which you can hear each week on HD2 or download his podcast. Welcome again, Matthew.
Hi, Jill.
One of the good news elements that we were talking about is if a few of these films hadn't already been available for anybody that didn't want to go to the big screen, maybe they can find them now?
I think all of the Best Picture nominees, with the exception of Phantom Thread, are now available on home video. So there's genuinely a boost right after the Oscars for curiosity's sake. I haven't seen Shape of Water yet, or I haven't seen Three Billboards yet, or even, you know, okay, I'll finally rent Get Out. There's something about the winning of the statue that drives people to go check it out more for curiosity's sake.
Speaking of Get Out and Frances McDormand and her big acceptance speech, it was diversity, diversity, diversity.
Right.
They've made their point. What do we need to watch for as the public to make sure that the filmmakers are really going to follow up with
this? Of course,
she
was talking, besides diversity in filmmaking, but she was also talking about diversity behind the scenes. What was key in her speech, besides Meryl, get up if you do it, everybody else will, but don't talk about it at the after party. You know, because it's easy to schmooze and go, babe, we'll talk. Yeah, we'll do something. No, Monday morning, 9 a.m., Let's start getting these projects done. What is Frances McDormand, if she wants to direct, or what's Greta Gerwig's next directing job going to be? You know, what kind of crew is she going to have? You know, what is Frances going to produce, or what is she going to star in next? So it's one thing to talk with champagne in your hand. It's another thing to do it at a desk Monday morning. So, and just keep hammering away.
So we, as the viewing public, what do we need
hopefully
to watch
we'll
for?
See some more personal stories. Hopefully we'll see something, because they're going to make the big studios are going to make big studio movies. It's looking for the smaller films, looking for the personal films, and looking for those that get a wider audience. A film, for instance, if it opens in New York in December, it won't trickle down to Indianapolis until like March. Hopefully they come faster and more accessible for all of us.
Well, speaking of which, then, any surprise winners or films or awards that now we might want to go out and try to see?
Not really, because I figured if they didn't give it to Three Billboards, which was my prediction, that it would probably go to Shape of Water. It's that's the more optimistic film. I was really happy, of course, for Jordan Peele. There's been a couple. It's About Times. One was for cinematographer Roger Deakins for Blade Runner. Another was for James Ivory for doing the screenplay for Call Me by Your Name.
See without my eyes the first time that you kiss.
Is there anything you don't know?
Boundless by the time I cry.
You only knew how little I know about the things that matter.
Build your walls around.
What things that matter?
White noise, what an awful sound.
You know what things.
Rolling by rolling.
You're saying what I think you're saying.
Shouldn't have said anything.
Just pretend you never did.
Nature has cunning ways of finding our weakest spot.
Blessed be the mystery of love.
Call me by your name and I'll call you by mine.
That's another one I think more people are going to see because it's lesser known, and they just know that Timothée Chalamet, who was up for Best Actor, and it was up for Picture and it was up for Actor. I think that'll get more tread. I think I, Tonya will get more tread because of Allison Janney winning.
I mean, when I was a kid, did you ever love me or anything?
You think Sonya Henie's mother loved her? Poor f***ing you. I didn't stay home making apple brown Bettys. No, I made you a champion. Knowing you'd hate me for it. That's the sacrifice a mother makes. I wish I'd had a mother like me instead of nice. Nice get your s***. I didn't like my mother either. So what? I gave you a gift.
So, yeah, I was really happy for those films that get a highlight. And anything that gets love for The Shape of Water and Three Billboards, I'm all for that.
How about if we want to learn more, go from being just a casual moviegoer to maybe not a real film expert like yourself, to be able to understand film more and be more in touch with movies? You've seen a lot of the movies that were up for nominations that didn't get nominated. Give us one that we might really want to go out and either see on the big screen or find it somewhere else.
Well, I think anything's worth seeing on the big screen. I don't care how impressive your TV or your laptop or your phone is. There is something about seeing it in a communal space. And I know audience etiquette is kind of dipped a little bit. I'm trying not to be the old man on the porch, but there is still nothing like seeing a movie on a big screen with a big crowd. And you know, a crowd can react, and you might not like the film and vice versa. But, I mean, that it's a communal experience. It's a gathering place, and I still think that should be done. So, yeah, seeing Dunkirk on a big IMAX screen.
Where are we going?
Dunkirk.
I'm not going back.
There's no hiding from this sun. We have a job to do.
If we go there, we'll die.
Something like the Florida Project.
It's only second week of the summer and there's already been a dead fish in the pool.
We were doing an experiment. We were trying to get it back alive. That was my idea.
And water balloons thrown at tourists. You can't f*** with tourists.
They didn't tip us.
Are you serious?
No.
Oh my God, this is unacceptable. I failed as a mother, Mooney. You've disgraced me.
Harley.
Yeah, Mom, you're disgraced.
Those are two contrastly different looking films, besides different stories that are being told. The way Christopher Nolan directs is different than the way somebody like Jordan Peele directs, or Martin McDonagh, who did Three Billboards, or Paul Thomas Anderson, who did Phantom Thread.
You can sew almost anything into the canvas of a coat. When I was a boy, I started to hide things in the linings of the garments. Things that only I knew were there. Secrets.
Good morning.
Will you have dinner with me?
If you want to learn more, I'm one of those. I always listen to commentary tracks on DVDs and Blu-rays. Yeah, I'm still one of those guys. I always believe there's two types of audience members. There are sitters and there are thinkers. Thinkers can sit and sitters can think. But I think you're rooted one way or another. And I think thinkers can enjoy a film and still go, wow, how'd they get that shot? Or what was the actor thinking when they had this moment? I'm one of those that always listens to the commentary tracks and the supplements, and a lot of those questions are answered that way. So more than just having it wash over you and then you go home. And there's nothing wrong with that. And there are films that are like that. Just keep digging, keep exploring.
Well, we will be exploring, watching, and listening to film sociology, and we'll talk with you again next time. Thank you, Matthew.
Thank you.
Just ahead on Curious Mix. We'll meet the OG of the CCIC.
Here, I'm mixing colors. I just started doing that today.
And offer up some ear candy for gearheads.
One of the things that people like to hear is the noise, so you can hear the powerful Novi going around in the 50s. So that's some different added bonuses to this exhibit.
I'm Jill Dittmeyer, and you're listening to Curious Mix.
It's time for our weekly segment called Making It, where WFYI's Melissa Davis profiles a local DIY, or do-it-yourself, artist. This week, we go into the multi-purpose community space with Alicia Smith, as she helps emerging writers fine-tune their craft, be it a play, a book, or a poem.
I run an event venue in Fountain Square attached to my office. Metonymy Media is the company I work for, and it's a writing company. And then in the back of our office is a venue called the Green Room.
This is the sharing portion. If anyone is super keen to share, you can go ahead and start off.
Okay. We just read the monologue part.
You read whatever you feel like sharing. You can read the monologue.
I'll just read the monologue. I got a case of deja vu today.
Making community is important to me, and I do think of it as a medium. Making community is a medium of expression. It's important to me because people only have access to the tools that they have access to, which means they can't execute their ideas and their goals if they don't have a computer with Adobe on it, you know, and they're a designer, you know, or they want to host a poetry reading, but they've never done so before. So what I do is go in and essentially...
I'd already lived this moment. I'm just in the other car.
Give people those resources. But it's, I mean, community organizing and, like, teaching people how to do it in a sustainable way. I guess, is what I do. So I don't make community so much as I make bridges for other people to make community.
For those of you who have not met Jeanette before, she is a renowned storyteller.
Place is really important. I mean, we're here in Indianapolis, and it's a one-of-a-kind place. I have only been living here for a year, but one thing I'll say for certain is that if you have a dream here, you can do it. But also, if you care about what is happening in the neighborhood and you become a part of that community, you're a part of it.
So we are in one of the brick storefronts with big windows next to Square Cat and across the street from the Hi-Fi, so it's a pretty recognizable spot. Anyone who's been to the Hi-Fi can look across the street and see or visualize, I guess, where we are. And we're right on Virginia, so it's like in the hubbub, which is great for like First Friday events and stuff because we get a lot of cross traffic, people coming in and out. So it's a good open, welcoming type environment and space. Is conducive. The space is conducive to people walking in and out and around, which is really good.
I don't know. Yes, I spent almost an hour with the doctor yesterday, and he did more than just look at me. We talked about a lot of things, and that's as far as I got.
What makes me keep going is a very difficult thought. It's there. I will tell you that for community organizing is something that really burns you out if you don't get paid. And when I was in graduate school and doing this just kind of because it's my grind and it's what I'm passionate about, I started to realize like, oh, I'm tired. I wish I could buy a bath bomb, but I have 50 cents to my name, you know? So I had to figure out how to make that sustainable. And when I was hired on at Metonymy, which is actually a writing company, and they specifically hire creative writers because they want to support the lifestyle of a creative writer, which is sometimes I need to work hungover in my bed, you know, that's okay. And they want to support us doing our best work in our best ideal environment, which is awesome. But when they hired me, they didn't know that I had this event planning background. And I came in for my interview and I saw the space and I was like, oh, not only could I do a ton of things with this if you just let me have access to it, if you helped me get money to pay people, are you kidding me? I could do so much. So I was able to finally find a way to make it sustainable for myself. And that's what keeps me going is I'm getting paid now to do this. And now that I have that backbone for myself and that foundation for myself, paying it forward so other people can have it is what's moving me now.
Alicia Smith runs Indie Word Lab.
And it's a local writer, preferably local. Sometimes I get touring people if I think that they're relevant. They do a reading, then they share an element of their craft, and then they issue a writing prompt. It's entirely free. And I typically provide light refreshments like wine.
Smith also lends her DIY organizer hand to a soul dance night and a number of arts and music festivals. That's Making It, reported and produced by Melissa Davis. Curious Mix is an audio archive of stories that celebrate the arts and culture in our communities. We take a visual visit to exhibits and events on our WFYI Facebook page. iPhoneographer Scott McAllister and I report live, giving our Facebook fans a sneak peek of what's happening right now in Indianapolis. One of our recent Facebook visits took us to the Indianapolis Motor Speedway Museum.
Jason Van Sickle, you were one of the people that put this together. And what makes it really interesting, I mean, obviously the gearheads are always into the engines, but those of us who see these fantastic machines go round and round, there's a lot of work underneath that we don't normally get to see, but we do with this exhibit.
Yeah, the engines are the star here. So the drivers get their fair share of celebration here, but the power plants that put them into victory lane really helps with that.
And once again, we're seeing them through the years as well, too, and how they've changed and developed.
Yeah, we have engines here from the early 1900s all the way to more modern engines of the mid-2000s.
And nowadays, everything gets listed that's in the engine, but back in the old days, it was just kind of short and sweet.
Yeah, you didn't have the computers or the technology that you had, but they were still high-tech in modern standards.
And they look so big and so huge, like they take up a lot of room.
Yeah, I mean, they were large cubic inch, four cylinders, six cylinders, eight cylinders, in some cases 16.
And this really is STEM education here, and you have a little bit of your own kind of hands-on interactive as well.
Yeah, so one of the things that people like to hear is the noise, so you can hear the powerful Novi going around in the 50s, so that's some different added bonuses to this exhibit.
So we get to listen to it the whole time, but guess what? You don't just have to listen to it. There it is right there.
Yeah, the Novi front and center here, just a very loud, brash car. That won a lot of hearts, did not do too well position-wise, but still carried the legend of the Novi.
And most of these engines, once again, you have a wide variety of them, and you've also taken them apart. So if it's not just enough to look at them, but you can actually come in and touch them.
Yeah, so everyone's heard of different components of the engines. With this exhibit, you can see how the engine is made here with this diagram. It goes through a four-stroke process. And then after you learn how the engine works, you can manipulate an Offenhauser engine, one of the more famous engines used here at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. You can check out what a piston looks like. You can handle it, see what the block is, crank, the names that you've heard before but maybe not seen because they're inside the engine.
Why did you guys decide to do an exhibit like this?
You know, the engines are something that fans clamor for. You know, horsepower and the noise brings people here, so putting the engines on display is something that was pretty good to do.
And where did you find these engines? I know you have a lot of the cars kept away, but where were the engines?
Yeah, it's still part of the collection. We are lucky to have a beautiful collection of cars, race car engines, passenger cars, pace cars also.
And here, once again, we can actually see where the engines used to be as opposed to where they are now.
Yeah, so the engines on the stand are part of this exhibit. We also have some cars that have the bodywork taken off. So this right here is the 68 wedge turbine, the Pratt & Whitney powered turbine engine that ran in 1968. Behind me is the Novi, the Preston Tucker Special, which ran in 1938, the first rear engine drive car to run with a slant six cylinder. And then the Cummins diesel 1931 nonstop car that ran on one tank of fuel.
And made in Indiana.
Yeah, made in Columbus, Indiana.
Wow. Well, the engines are a pretty sweet little exhibit here, Jason, but I know you guys have another area of the museum that I'm guessing you've had a lot of people come and want to see this, because just talk about dreams aplenty and bringing back a lot of good memories for people.
Yeah, so one of the traditions that the 500 started was the pace car, and in 2017 it was the 50th anniversary of the Camaro. So the Camaro has paced the Indianapolis 500 nine times, the Brickyard 400 another three times. To celebrate that milestone, we have the Camaro 50 Years of Setting the Pace exhibit. So we have all the Camaros that paced the race from 1967 all the way to this year with this year's Brickyard 400 pace car.
What is it about the Camaro, the style of the Camaro? I mean, it's a car that men love, women love, all ages love this car.
You know, it's that iconic pony car proportions. It's a long hood, short deck, speed. Convertibles help with that, too, with the wind in people's hair. That's one of the things that people grasp onto the Camaro.
You can see more of that story and other Facebook Live segments on our WFYI Facebook page. Keep listening as Curious Mix continues. The Circle City Industrial Complex, or CCIC, is that sprawling turquoise building in downtown Indianapolis. It stretches from the corner of 10th Street along Brookside Avenue. Today, parts of the former diesel engine factory are used as storage for food trucks and workspace for makers. The Centerpoint Brewery anchors the south end, and in the middle of the building, artists gather in galleries and studios. And it's been the studio home to artist Martha Narwald for over 25 years. Curious Mix contributor Joy Hernandez spent some time with Martha, learning more about her art.
I do call it controlled chaos, but still it has a mind of its own. And so I just have to go with what it's doing. I go with the flow, as they say.
Narwald has developed her marbled impressionism over the course of about a dozen years.
It is a form of hand marble paper that's been around for centuries, but I take it steps beyond that. So it's a little bit representational, a little bit impressionistic, a little bit abstract.
Narwald recounted the history of her medium. Marbling paper began in China and was further developed in Japan and Persia before making its way to Europe.
And the only thing that's different now is instead of watercolors mixed with ox gall to make them float, I use acrylic inks that are made especially to float. And instead of using carrageenan, which is the boiled seaweed, I use methyl cellulose.
That word flows off Narwald's tongue thanks to her background as a toxicologist, with a degree in zoology and a minor in chemistry.
And what I do now is art, but I have to have that understanding of the chemistry and physics behind it. I do an experimental water media, and so I am still experimenting. I experiment with different solvents, with different inks that generally are not used for marbling. I make different kinds of equipment to apply the inks.
She mixes her inks in small cups and begins laying out her design in a pan of methocellulose, thick, gloppy goo that acts as her canvas. Using a small glass wand, Narwald dabs the inks and a landscape of mountains, sky, and brush begins to appear. She's practiced her tree technique in various experiments, and soon gray ink pushes apart the other colors to form a trunk. With a small handmade broom, Narwald flicks greens and blues into the leaves. The colors marble through the mixture, giving depth and creating sinuous shapes, bringing to mind Narwald's favorite live oaks.
Here, I'm mixing colors. I just started doing that today.
Her canvas is complete, and now it's time to capture the image.
The paper is first brushed with a solution of aluminum sulfate. Aluminum sulfate is a mordant, and a mordant will make a chemical bond so that the pigment will not rinse off the paper.
Narwald rolls the paper onto the pan so as not to disturb the ink scene she's created. She then lifts the paper out, rinses it in her reclaimed sink, and pins it above to dry. No two paintings are ever alike, and the inks and solvents never interact in just the same way. Sometimes Narwald finds imagery in her art that she never intended.
I found dragons in a piece that I hadn't intended for dragons, but there were maybe 30 dragons in it. Another one was of maybe 3 fish, but it turned out there were about 100 fish in there. And I would love to be able to do that, but it's on rare occasions when I find these. I call them my found objects.
Found objects in the expansive building Narwald calls home. She's happy with the addition of all her new neighbors as the CCIC regains its vibrancy.
Oh, I'm just so pleased, and it's so much fun to be here. It's fun to have artists because artists give inspiration to each other. It's fun to have the woodworkers and metal fabricators in the back because they think in a different way, and it's just great to get all these ways of looking at things.
For Curious Mix, I'm Joy Hernandez.
How can a poem inspire a visual artist? Like this. Here's Curious Mix contributor Terry Border.
Well, I had an aquarium about all my life until this year. And finally, I just was busy with other things, and I couldn't keep it up, so I gave it away. So one day, I'm on the internet, and I thought I'd see if there was a poem named called Aquarium or about an aquarium. So sure enough, here we go. This is called Aquarium by Kim Adonisio. The fish are drifting calmly in their tank between the green reeds, lit by a white glow that passes for the sun. Blindly, the blank glass that holds them in displays their slow progress from end to end. Familiar rocks set in the gravel, murmuring rows of filters. A universe of flying fox and glass cats, Congo tetras, bristlenose placostomus, all take for granted. Yet, the platies, gold and red, persist in leaping occasionally, as if they can't quite let alone a possibility of wings, maybe, Once they reach the air, they die on the rug. We find them there, eyes open with surprise.
You going to get another aquarium?
I think we're going to have to at some point, something smaller. I had a really big one. Or also we're thinking about a koi pond, maybe. Maybe that'll be a little easier.
That's Terry Border. He'll be back next week with another poem and maybe a koi pond. Still to come on Curious Mix, Roger knocks out Parkinson's.
I'm here to say boxing words are therapy words. I'm not a scientist, I'm not a neurosurgeon, but I am a cheerleader.
And Yoko sings a song.
All day long, I felt like smashing my face in a clear glass window. But instead...
Another of our regular Curious Mix contributors is Kyle Long. He hosts WFYI's Cultural Manifesto. Listen in as he asks a local musical mad scientist of sorts to share his five favorite songs.
I'm Kyle Long from Cultural Manifesto, and I'm here today with Matt All. Matt is the director of the Loathed Sound Department and author of a zine called Cretans of Distortion. Before we get into your selections, just give us a quick kind of sketch of what Loathed Sound is.
Loathed Sound is a collection of different titles that I re-release on cassette tape for as cheap as possible and get it out as cheap as possible. Most of them are avant-garde or different than anything you've ever heard.
It's experimental music kind of coming out of the Midwest often, right?
Yeah. It's pretty much experimental music from the Midwest and then Jamaican records that are really cool.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So that's the split. Gotcha. So what's your first pick for us today?
So yeah, my first choice is by Winston Williams. It's called People's Choice, and it's a version of Ain't Too Proud to Beg by Marvin Gaye, in which he does super reverbed DJ shout-outs over the top of it the entire time. It's really cool.
This thing comes on strong. You can't go wrong. Monster of his trade, that's why he has it made, baby. Sharper than a razor blade. My girls say I'm sweeter than Sugar Ray. And greater than Cassius Clay every day.
My second selection is Make Me Yours by Phyllis Dillon. Another Jamaican version that's fantastic and really interesting instrument styles for Jamaica.
Was about to give you, then you came along, just a heavy and little bit way, thrilled me for days and days. I don't care what nobody says.
Number three.
Number three is Sometimes I Feel Like Smashing My Face in a Clear Glass Window by Yoko Ono. A wild song, but also one of the more palatable.
All day long, I felt like smashing my face in a clear glass window. But instead,
number four, my next track is by Vertical Slit off their album Slit and Pre-Slit. It's called In No Sense 1x2. They're an experimental band from Columbus, Ohio, and their record only came out of 100. but people like David Bowie were one of the 100 people to get it and would later go on to cite this as a really important record to them. And a really cool guy named Jim Shepherd made all of it. Fifth and Finals by Charles Tyler, a free jazz artist out of Indianapolis. He spent a lot of time with Albert Ayler, and that song is Sha Lacey Out East, and it's a song with no drummer, just bass, cello, and alto saxophone, but incredibly rhythmic and groovy.
Matt, I want to give folks another reminder. They can purchase your cassettes online at loathedsound.com. And not only are these archival reissues, you also have a contemporary title or two, including Indianapolis's own African rock band, Sweet Poison Victim, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Anything you have coming up with the label you want to share?
There will hopefully be another Sweet Poison Victim tape soon. I'm really hoping they'll let me do a live tape at Bockold Hall, their old practice space in Hallville. But we'll see if they let me do that or not.
Awesome. The label is Loathed Sound, and the zine is Cretans of Distortion. Thank you, Matt, for the five songs.
Thank you.
Each week, Kyle explores the history, harmony, and humanity of Indiana music on Cultural Manifesto. You can hear it online or on 90.1, Wednesday nights at 8 and Saturday nights at 10. Let's be honest. When you think of boxing, you're more likely to think about brain injury, not brain health. Well, not so for a Lafayette man who is using both boxing and art therapy in his fight against Parkinson's disease. Curious Mix contributor Lee Danoon has the story.
Show me what you got. Come on.
3 days a week, you'll find Roger Jenkins boxing at the YMCA in Kokomo.
I was diagnosed at age 47, 12 years ago, and I had a steady downhill. I first thought I would hide my disease. You don't hide from anybody.
Jenkins discovered Rocksteady Boxing 3 years ago, an intense fitness program for people with Parkinson's who deal with symptoms like rigid muscles, trouble with movement, and weakness of face and throat muscles.
Exercise is an overlooked medicine and has been proven by a study in a college here in Indianapolis that Rocksteady Boxing can slow down and even stop the progression of Parkinson's.
Jenkins has noticed improvement in his flexibility, especially in his legs. He credits boxing for helping his balance and improving his gait. A year and a half ago, Jenkins added another valuable tool. He says they work in concert with each other. Once a week, Jenkins drives to the IU Neuroscience Center in Indianapolis to take part in art therapy.
Roger, come on in.
Heron School of Art and Design Art Therapy graduate student Jesse Swihart is a trained psychotherapist who works with Jenkins and other patients with serious neurodegenerative diseases. She says the strategic use of different mediums during therapy, like clay, paints, or pencils, helps the patients express difficult emotions.
It might be easier to talk about it one day, or it might be easier to just
focus on the art and speak through the art. And that's one of the blessings that we have here. If they can't express it verbally, they express it through visual image.
This unique program was created by neurologist Dr. Robert Pascuzzi and Heron Art Therapy Professor Juliette King. King says the physical and psychological implications of these diseases like Parkinson's and ALS can be daunting for patients, and it can lead to debilitating depression.
It really provides an opportunity for us to step in and support the coping skills and the social emotional aspects of what it means to be alive and to be alive with a newly diagnosed or an old diagnosed condition.
Chairman of the IU School of Medicine's Department of Neurology, Pascuzzi says he's always trying to find the most complete treatments for patients, knowing they need more than just conventional medicine. That's why art therapy is so important.
I think that's where the patients have the best chance to do well long term.
Which one of these are we going to do today?
Well, let's check it out.
Jenkins says he is not artsy, nor was he initially inclined to embrace art therapy, but he's changed his tune.
It is the best kept secret because art therapy is a whole lot more than just making pictures. It's exploring unexplored parts of your brain and your personality. And it can be therapeutic and healing at the same time.
Jenkins' new goal is to say yes to new experiences because of the extraordinary consequences he's discovered.
That's what I intend to keep doing, because if there's some benefit, I'm going to find it.
For Curious Mix, I'm Lee Dinoon.
Hope you've enjoyed listening to our Curious Mix, but before we leave, it's time once again to open our eyes as well as our ears.
This weekend, wake up early for some Jovian discovery. I'm Matt Pelser, and this is your Weekend Sky Report. Jupiter, Mars, and Saturn are all out in the pre-dawn hours, but just as Jupiter is the largest planet in the solar system, indeed about as large and massive as a planet can physically be as we know it, it's also the brightest object in the morning sky these days. If you're up around 6, look to the south for a bright star that doesn't twinkle. That's Jupiter. You can't miss it. One of the best ways to enjoy Jupiter is through a telescope. Any telescope, even a toy telescope or binoculars, should allow you to see the planet's 4 largest moons. Because they were discovered by Galileo Galilei in 1610, we call Ganymede, Callisto, Io, and Europa the Galilean moons. And when he first saw the moons, he thought they were fixed stars behind Jupiter. But when some of them would disappear and reappear depending on when he was observing, he concluded that they were natural satellites, moons. And they're some of the largest moons in the solar system. All but Europa are bigger than our own moon. You may have heard that Jupiter has quite a few moons, but those 4 make up most of the material orbiting the giant planet by a long shot. In fact, 99.99% of the total mass of all 69 of Jupiter's moons is tied up in those 4 Galilean moons. The rest are tiny by comparison, some just a kilometer across. So when you wake up early to check out Jupiter, put yourself in Galileo Galilei's shoes. What it must have been like to see those moons for the first time more than 400 years ago. I'm Matt Pelser. Happy sky watching.
Curious Mix is made possible in part by the Arts Council of Indianapolis. Brandon Meeks composed our music. This Curious Mix was created by
Terry Border,
Roxana Caldwell,
Melissa Davis,
Sarah Neil Estes,
Kyle Long,
Matt Pelser,
Matthew Sosi,
Joy Hernandez,
Lee Dinoon,
and me, Jill Dittmeyer. We'll be back again next week with more Curious Mix.